We are the ink to the page, Japan land the punch. Anamana Pia Boom Pow, we got the stuff. We know they got story, been new, they got hot. Complex narratives and black carries, tell me where you see us. Where I see us, where I see us, they wanna be us. But tell me where they read us, not they wanna be us. Out the damn cage like a nigga from Georgia. Insane and out the brain and lacking in origin. Act flashbacks and shots to the system. Downloading new issues and sitting for a listen. Where I see us, where I see us, they wanna be us. But tell me where they read us, not they wanna be us.
Where I see us,
where I see us.
Welcome back to another episode of Where I See Me, the podcast where we look at comics and media with lots of questions in mind, mainly, where the hell are the black and brown people? And so I'm Jamie.
And I am Marcellus.
Marcellus, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I feel like today has been a beautiful day. I woke up. Cats were in a good mood. I was in a good mood. I feel like it would be lying to say I woke up early. But I woke up feeling rested, which is the important part.
Okay.
But it's been nice. I feel like, especially up in Pennsylvania right now, there's not much. Like, I think about this time being in Houston, maybe last year, and being like, oh wow, the air's not fire, it's not only 100 degrees today.
ERCOT already was like, can y'all conserve power so we don't have to turn the power off on y'all? Yes. so we're in an excessive heat advisory. I've never even heard of that before, so I'm glad that you were enjoying cooler weather.
I just appreciate that I can have my windows open and it does something. I haven't turned the AC on yet this summer. Yeah, so like it's warm, but it's like fine. If there's a breeze, I'm more than good. So not trying to make you jealous or anything.
Wow.
How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited about today's episode.
So can I do it? Could I?
The surprise. Yes. Please.
So the surprise. We have a wonderful special guest for today's episode. Someone who forever has a preamble I will always give and a section of my heart. Kayla Myers, wonderful friend, artist, programmer, I'll say Queen of Memphis. I'll give you that unofficial title. Unofficial title.
Wow.
Welcome to the podcast, Kayla.
Thank you so much. There's some folks in Memphis who are going to be like, that's debatable. There are so many other queens of Memphis, but I am honored that you gave me that title. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm really, really excited to be here. So thank you all for having me.
Yeah, you're the first guest we've had on in a while, because it's like with our life situations and stuff, like it's been hard to coordinate guests. And so I'm just putting this as a disclaimer for, because people, I'm sure somebody's gonna be like, well, you haven't had us in the show. And although none of our guests are really like that, but maybe people who listen are like, why haven't y'all had, you know, people like to be messy. But it's been, you know, because sometimes we'll have to cancel on each other. And so we can't do that to a third person. You know, like so we're really, I'm glad everything worked out with all of our schedules and that we're here together for this episode.
I feel like beyond wanting another excuse to talk to you, Kayla, I also feel like considering how often I have brought up some of the work that you've been doing, and even primarily just the festival that you're working with, too, Jamie. I feel like every year that I was in Houston, I was watching or doing something with Indie Memphis and not shutting up about it. So it felt like, I think, very apt time to be able to, the 1 year I can't be in person, to do that to Jamie. We have to have on. But I was wondering if you can, I guess, tell us a little bit about, well, one, how we know each other, and also just how, what you have been up to lately, what you're doing this summer.
I feel like I'm sitting here thinking about how long we've actually known each other, and it's so wild to me that it's been like almost a decade, which does not make any sense. Time is but yes, Marcellus and I originally met because I was his RA at our lovely, lovely undergrad, the University of Missouri. And I taught a documentary journalism freshman interest group, which I don't think actually still exists anymore at Mizzou. Or at least it doesn't in the same way. Like I don't, when I was leaving, they were starting to like rework some of that. But it was this like really cool program where, I mean, arguably, should I have been teaching? Maybe not. But because I was 20 teaching a documentary journalism class. I was kind of attached to a program at Mizzou that does still exist. And I had residents who were interested in that. They didn't have to study that in the rest of college, but we kind of talked about documentaries and everything in that class. And then Marcellus and I both did the digital storytelling program at Mizzou, which I always kind of describe as this like interdisciplinary, like film and video art and writing kind of degree program. It was really kind of choose your own adventure in those first couple of years. I think it's a little bit more formalized now. And now they have like a projection mapping class, and I'm so jealous. Because I was doing some projection stuff towards the end of college, and they didn't have that class yet, but I graduated and did not get to take it. But that's how we got connected and just stayed friends and followed each other's work in the time since. And I right now primarily work as a film programmer and Black Creators Forum manager at Indie Memphis. I'm probably most known for our film festival that Marcellus mentioned that we always have in the fall. And this year it's in October, October 24th through the 29th. And so at the festival, I program short films for the festival every year. And that includes music videos and then also our, what we call our hometowners, which are filmmakers who are based here in the Mid-South in Memphis. And then I also manage our Black Creators Forum program that Marcellus has also attended. That is a really beautiful experience that I'm so glad to work with other people to make happen, Amanda and Miriam in particular. Miriam is our artistic director, and Amanda is a filmmaker who also works with me as a BCF producer. And it started off just as a conference that was really geared towards, because we're a general film festival, but we do have a focus on Black and Brown filmmakers and just marginalized filmmakers in general. And so we wanted a space because Memphis is a predominantly Black city, and we wanted to make sure there was clear space for Black filmmakers to be with each other, to share resources, to like ask questions and be in panels that could really benefit them, especially if there's someone who's emerging. And so BCF usually includes, has for the past couple of years been this like virtual experience that we weren't quite sure when we first did it how that was going to work, but it has really like continued to be a really incredible space. It's my favorite Zoom chat I've ever been in. The chat is always just so like exciting and funny and really supportive. And then this year we'll actually bring back the in-person component of BCF, which we haven't done since 2019. So yeah, those are kind of the things that I'm up to. I'm watching a lot of submissions right now, and we're also reading for our residency and fellowship for screenwriting for Black filmmakers. That the residency was another thing we had to pause for the pandemic, but we've brought it back. So that's been another big thing that as the summer has started, I have been working on. So watching a lot, reading a lot, which is really, really exciting. But that's it in a nutshell for the most part.
I'm really curious, and being someone who's been able, you know, lucky enough to participate in some of what you've been talking about, like especially the forum in particular, even just seeing how much goes into grabbing screeners and reviewers for all the different facets of making this festival and the various programs in it run. How, or could you describe, I guess, what it's been like having that transition from out of higher education and then going towards not just making things, but making sort of experiences, like the programming aspect of what you're doing? How has that sort of like road been for you?
Yeah, it's been a time. I think actually being an RA in college was actually really beneficial for shifting into the job that I have now. I honestly didn't quite know that programming existed until towards the end of college, and I met Miriam at True Falls. She asked if I was interested. She DM'd me and asked if I was going to True Falls, and I was like, yes, because at the time I was like, I probably won't go again for another little while. But now I get to go and be for work. But I went that year, that was 2019. I went in 2019 and met Miriam there. And I started off just as like helping with the residency process for that year. And then eventually started helping my former colleague Bridget with the shorts programming. But I, having the experience of like being required to plan events as an RA, I think sort of like sowed the seeds of the things that I have to think about now with thinking about the film festival, but also just like things that we do for VCF. And especially last year, we're thinking about like the brunch that we had, like even just thinking about all of these pieces that you really don't realize make an event happen or make a film festival happen. But also just really having appreciation for like clear communication of like the goals of something, the experience you want people to have. So like planning the like one-off kind of diversity conversations we had in college, or asking professors to come speak in the hall. That's like very similar to us asking filmmakers to come to the festival and like talk about their work or talk about things in BCF. So it's not something that I realized until I started doing this job that I was like, oh, that like, yes, like being an RA was helpful for me in tuition, but it was also coincidentally helpful for the things that I do now. And so I think my brain was kind of already slightly more tuned to having to think about those things, but there's so much I've learned over the past 4 years in terms of even like the nitty gritty logistical things of like how much work it takes to get a film shown in a theater. And I just have so much appreciation for all of the moving pieces. Like I'm just one part of all of the other things that it takes to get a film screened. And I feel like I really try to emphasize that with people now, that there are all of these parts and roles. Like I get to have the role where like I'm a little bit more front facing, so you sometimes know who the programmer is, but you don't always know who the projectionist is, who's making the screening really, really work, or the technical person who figured out that like the files are good. So things like that that I think are becoming even more important to think about with like labor in this industry. And yeah, so I think transitioning to this was like, I learned a lot in terms of the things that you have to think about for screening, but also just like doing this work where I grew up, but coming back home as an adult, like there are things that of course like I want to see in Memphis, but also really, you know, really trying to reacquaint myself with what Memphis is like now, because I was gone for actually 5 years. And I've never lived here as an adult until now, like to really be able to see what spaces have continued while I was gone or what spaces exist now that didn't before. I think that was another big thing that I think I'm still sort of like getting reacquainted with. Like Memphis is always front and center for me, but I am really like, you know, becoming more and more like feeling settled of like, this is what I know my Memphis to be like growing up, but then also what it is currently now. And that's something that I think when you're programming for a specific place, not every film festival, not every organization is always programming with the place they are in mind, but that's really what we are always trying to do. And I'm always planning to do when I program, whether it's at Indie Memphis or if it's somewhere else in the future.
Can you, I'm very curious about your time, when you're talking about your time as an RA preparing you for the role now, and then also really curious about this class that Marcellus took with you, the documentary interest, is that, did I get the title right? Okay. What was that class like? Like, what were y'all covering in the class? Were y'all watching documentaries? Were y'all having like, the like teacher in me is very, very curious.
Oh, yeah. yeah, we were, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about this class in so long. The way that I think, because we were like, I was paired with a faculty person, so it wasn't just me like willy-nilly deciding what we were teaching, but I did have a lot of like liberty in terms of what we actually talked about, and Stacy, who was my faculty person, just kind of like he guided where it made sense to. And so we did, like, at first week was just looking at like different forms of documentary, or really like ways that people approach the form, from the like more like observational to more reflexive kind of work. And then we kind of moved into thinking about like documentary ethics, like what are the things you have to think about as like a filmmaker, or really as almost kind of like as a journalist also, because it was within a J school and they were teaching it in a way that I think was broad enough that not everyone had to do it in a journalistic way, but I was also an aspect of it. My second year that I taught it, we did have a week on like women in documentary film. Yeah, Marcellus, is there anything else that you remember us talking about?
Well, I remember it being interesting that, because I mean, it's it being, just thinking about the FIG program in general at that period in time, where it's all freshmen, and I mean, you were a year ahead of me, so a sophomore teaching freshmen alongside a faculty member, but like you really got to like sort of Stacy was there in case like the handbrake was needed, but it was never needed, so it was very much getting to learn all of these different modes and I guess approaches to documentary, but also the fact that we were asked to, you know, to react and respond and to write. And I think also even thinking back, I only remember one project that we made in that class, and I want to say it was mockumentary was the mode we chose to do. And I'm sure I could find it somewhere, and it's ridiculous, but I do remember just feeling like it was great to be able to embrace something and making something that didn't scrutinize the fact that we were exploring, because I do feel like the further into, and this is outside of being, not being someone who had gone further into the documentary program and jumped ships to a different different major. But I think there's that fear of, if I don't do it a specific way, it won't have integrity or won't be able to be something of quality. And I feel like you and Stacey did a really good job of sort of extinguishing that worry and just letting us learn how to make stuff first.
Yeah. And I feel like also because, like, even though I was a baby teaching fellow babies, I did like want, I think some of the things that I think about now as a programmer, I was really thinking about then in terms of just like making sure that even as makers that we were all thinking critically about what we were watching, because I think I did one lesson on this HBO documentary series called The Jinx that had this whole like sort of ethical dilemma where they had the audio still on for the the main sort of person that was on. So like things like that like I may not have been as articulate about them as I think I hopefully am now, but like really trying to like sow those seeds for them, for myself, especially as they continued on. Whether or not they did Doc J or if they just continued in art in some other form or fashion. So
was the Jinx that series where it was the man who was like allegedly like killed his wives and then at the mic he was in the bathroom mumbling talking about how he it's not funny, but it's like, sir.
The way he got caught is if you hadn't given us all of the details, we would have thought it was like made up. But that's what happened.
Wild times.
So Kayla, you talked a great length about like working as a programmer, but I'm really interested in your own like artistic practice as a filmmaker and the things that you're interested in. So what really kind of first drew you to film as a art medium?
Yeah, I think I feel like I came to it initially through like watching things with my parents, and I had very like different watch experiences with them. Like my mom, it was like romantic comedy, any of the like black romantic dramas from like the 90s and early 2000s, like that's a lot of what I watched with her and still watch with her. And then with my dad, it was more of a mixed bag of like sci-fi, maybe some horror, a lot of Stephen King and like The Twilight Zone, like those things, and older movies in general. Like he really encouraged that half of my own sort of like film interest, but I don't think I came to it as my own like artistic practice until I was probably in like late high school. And because before that I was like a really big reader and read a lot of books and had all the AR points. And then moved into visual art that I did for most of like a good part of middle school. And then as I got into high school, I got more into photography and was in like a theater and TV program where I did like theater and then I did TV video work. Although I very quickly figured out I did not want to do broadcast. That was not my ministry whatsoever. Just not for me. I prefer the stress of like a film festival than like the stress of broadcast news. And so I knew that I liked images, like that was images and image making. And by the time I finished high school, I figured out that I wanted it to be in the, like a photography or video sort of space. And working in that way because I, you know, had started. And I also feel like this was like coincidentally with like Instagram had just come out within like my sophomore, junior year of high school, whatever time that was. And I feel like that was really encouraging my own sort of like development as a photographer. And then I, you know, eventually like asked for cameras as you do for like Christmas and things like that. And so when I started in college, I started with initially thinking I was going to be a photojournalist. And I still loved movies. I think a lot of my movie education I did on my own and did a lot of like reading of blogs and things like that when I was in high school, because those were still really like popular and viable then in a way that they aren't really now, which is a whole other conversation. But I really figured out that like I liked reading other people thinking about movies and thinking about media in general and like really thoughtful ways. I was like, I don't know if I want to write, but I also want to like make images. So I don't know what that really means and looks like. And so finding digital storytelling in college was like a really like open way of thinking about it, because it wasn't as strict as like being in the film program or film production. But was still like a way for me to make work and have access to equipment, but then also be exposed to some of the things in our classes that, especially more experimental stuff that I just had never seen before. Like I had seen some of the like movies that we ended up watching in class, which Katina was always like, "Hey, how have you already seen this?" But love her so much. But then I was exposed to more experimental things that I think really expanded my own ideas of like my own artistic practice and being more comfortable with like not being as narrative as I think a lot of us are used to growing up and seeing. And so as much as I haven't made as much of my own work over the past few years, when I was like finishing out in college, I was feeling more comfortable with like being less like narrative about the way that I was approaching my own work. I still, you know, dabbled a little bit in writing, and the most of what I've done in my own work now is outside of programming has been film like writing. But I think that's how I kind of came to it, of like I wanted a way to use images, and digital storytelling really afforded me like a really kind of like, she never said like, this is the only way that you can do
this particular project
or this particular work. And I really appreciated that experience in college, because I think in high school it had been a bit more kind of prescriptive, and I was really afforded an openness that I think I really needed, because like I'm an earth sign and I'm very structure based, and having the space to like let my brain just like do the thing or just make the image was something I really appreciated about that program ever speaking.
There's like a lot. I'm like digesting everything that you've said, because I'm like, you're on the Twilight Zone. That was also like, my mom watched a lot of the Twilights. A lot of my sci-fi interest comes from my mom, which is funny because she doesn't watch any of that stuff now anymore. It's just strictly, it's just like strictly Westerns and police procedurals now.
That's my dad. He just says on all the time.
I think they're obligated to. I think there's just a certain point where you have to.
It's a big like contract.
Like once you hit that age.
Real quick again, just a shout out to Katina Bitsikas for doing the darn thing for digital storytelling. I feel like there's so much that she put into that program and continues to put into that program that makes it so accessible. And it's funny seeing how I feel like, because she's the reason I got to grad school, and I think about how many students of color that she kind of made the effort to to like really stand by, because there were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of places and different programs that didn't know what to do with us. Like I have a vivid memory, and granted, I feel like I'm sure they don't teach there now, or maybe if they do, I don't know. I apologize if I get in trouble for saying this. But I remember being in a journalism class the first year, maybe the semester after taking your class, Kayla, where they said 25% of us will probably stay here, like in the major, like stick to the major.
Okay.
And then they made a distinct mark to say it'll be even less for Black students. And there was an emphasis on just like the difficulty and all of these other things. And I remember I had to take a class with Katina the second semester, just as part of everything I was doing. And the more they talked negatively about just like, this is what it's like to make things. There is no light at the end of the tunnel unless you are the top cream of the crop. And she was like, hey, she actively kept telling me to change major.
To change what?
To digital storytelling from journalism.
Okay.
So she you could just tell there were so many students who wanted to make work and were becoming disgruntled in a little bit. And I power to her for being able to take our like readiness to make things and actually give us tools without fear-mongering.
I'm so curious about, you know, anytime a professor starts a class with like, some of you, you know, look to your left, look to your right, that person may be here, you know, like that kind of you know, weeding out intimidation tactics. I would hope that if there are any incoming freshmen into any kind of program like that are listening, like, you should really question, like, well, okay, well, what are you doing to retain these students? You know, like if you know it's so difficult for students of color, for Black students to be here and they don't make it through the program, it's not necessarily, it doesn't mean that it's a fault on your Black students. It's something about your program that you might need to, you know, look at a little bit closely. But I mean, of course, Marcellus, you and I both work in academia. We know they don't be one to look.
No. Look at
their, they're like, we just want to leave this stuff as it is. You know, we're not trying to fix anything. You come in, you only gonna be here 4 years. I'm gonna fix stuff. You know, they don't. But they really should. Like, I would encourage students to ask them, well, what are y'all doing about that? Because that's terrible. That's a really terrible thing to say on the first day of class. That y'all, only 25% of y'all are going to make it. Wow. And, you know, also, I remember, Marcellus, you were telling me, and y'all were both at Mizzou at the same time. Y'all were at Mizzou during Ferguson, when all of the stuff was happening there. And y'all aren't, the school isn't that far from
Ferguson? Not at all.
Did that ever come up in any of the classes? Things, the like the exterior climate? I mean, I know like students were organizing, but like actual conversation in the classrooms, did that ever happen?
I'll only speak, I guess, from my experience in terms of, I mean, because for me, I was split between digital storytelling and the other major I did was film. And you couldn't, I loved the film program and I loved some of the courses. And I love, you know, I'm really kind of picking pieces of it to single out. But broadly, you'd be pulling teeth to get a conversation about anything happening actively in that program. Really, it was for the students. Like, if the students made work, we could talk about that piece. And that was the window. Digital storytelling was a little bit different. I feel like both in the professors that were placed inside that program to lead it, and also just like, I just feel like the makeup of students between those two programs for me was very different. More female students, more queer students, more black students. So we were actively, I feel like, having more of those conversations. Not every class, I feel like, lended itself easily to that, but the ones that did made some degree of effort to at least have something on topic or give us space to talk about things. Yeah, what about you, Kayla? How would you describe your experience around that time?
Yeah. I mean, Ferguson was my first semester of college, and the first protest that I ever went to, like, as an adult human, was a protest for Michael Brown on the Zoom campus. And I remember talking to my mom after I went, and she was like, "Oh my gosh, like, you're kind of a protester. She's protesting." And I was like, yeah, I feel like this is something that felt right to do, and in that moment in particular, and like having classmates who were from the area, and then year after having the like movements that we had on Mizzou's campus, and I think, you know, are of course like in relationship and correlation to the organizing at Ferguson the year before. I think part of the reason that I ended up, I stayed in journalism, but I didn't stay in the side of journalism that was like reporting. I ended up doing strategic communication, which is sort of the more marketing advertising side of the J school, and often the side that like has more people. And but before that, like, everyone has to take these 2 years of like baseline journalism classes. And at the time of the movements at Mizzou, like, I was in a multimedia journalism class. And the day that they kind of announced some things happening in terms of like the president or whoever stepping down, there was a lot of like organizing at a particular part of campus where the concerned student protesters were camping out. And I distinctly remember being in class one of those days and them saying, like, just go out and for the rest of the day, just report on whatever you see and have it be submitted by insert this time. Like, take whatever video or photos or whatever. And I think that for me was like the moment where I was like, I'm not sure this is for me. Like, I'm not sure this is the way that I would like to operate, like, to be in this classroom that the professor is not really saying anything about why this is happening and what context we should have for going out and talking to people. And so I think that like really solidified for me that I was like, I don't think this kind of journalism is what I would like to do. I don't know if I want to be a journalist. I think maybe I would like to consider something else, because there was just so much like context that like are the white students and other students on campus just like did not have for why going up to someone in this particular moment and that particular experience could be really difficult, and that there was history prior to that at Mizzou, like a protest movement that would make for better, stronger reporting rather than just like going out there and asking questions. And so I feel like we talked about it some, and those, like, as Marcella said, like amongst ourselves as students, but how much it really became a conversation and like that thorough of a consideration. Like, I had one class that we also all had to take that was like multicultural journalism, and that professor, like, she was truly like down for the cause. She really forced conversations to happen in that class that like made a lot of classmates really uncomfortable, as they should have been. Like, we're in a program that is still predominantly white, and there's a lot that those students had not considered. We all had to take that class like sophomore year of college. And that's the most overt experience I had in a classroom setting within the J school. And I'm maybe it's different now, so I can't speak to how it is now. This is like 8 years ago, 7 years ago, whatever time. Yeah. And so there was just, you know, a real lack of, and I think this is a problem in journalism overall. It's not even just this particular school, but I think, that class in particular, and just some of the like conversations we had amongst ourselves were the most sort of overt that we really got about the other things that were happening in Missouri at that time. Because it's very weird to like go to a school and be in a state where there are very clear like movements happening that influence the rest of that decade and now.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to kind of, at least with certain groups of people, for it to not feel like something that you really need to talk about. Because I had to talk with residents about, that was the first year I was an RA, like I had to talk with residents about what was happening, what they were feeling. Then I had to take time for myself to be like, what am I feeling? What is happening? And there wasn't quite that support there yet. And I hope there is now, except for like the places. A lot of the social justice centers were in the basement of the student center, and that's really where another space for support in that way also. It's weird. It's very weird. I feel like I think back to that now, and it's like we were at Missouri at a very particular time, mm-hmm. and for the ways that the university has thought about these things, has thought about its own history. Which is just like an indication of many, many other things. They don't really want to consider these parts
That seems to be, you know, when y'all were at Mizzou, I was in Florida, in the panhandle of Florida. But I was in a grad school program that, you know, they marketed themselves as a social, I was in grad school for art therapy, and they were marketing mm-hmm. themselves or were known as a social justice program. And we never talked about any of the things that were happening in that decade. And some of the things, you know, for instance, Trayvon Martin was in Florida and Jordan Dunn was also in Florida. It never came up in class, and we are training to be, you know, future therapists. Me and my friend Brittany, we were the only two Black students in the class. And so me and her, like, you know, on break, sometimes we talk about the cases and things because we're kind of following along. And I will never forget my housemate. I regret very few things in my life. I regret living in a house with them two girls. She was sitting next to me, and we were talking about, I think, the Jordan Dunn case. And she was like, what's the big deal? People die every day.
Oh.
And, you know, I think, not to defend her, right? Like, I'm not thinking about defending her at all, but it's just kind of like, I guess she just heard us talking about a case and, like, that someone has been killed. And she's like, what's the big deal? Because she, you know, she's from, this girl is she's white. Her mom is Asian, but she's white. From South Florida. South Florida, like, is a whole other world into itself. Mm-hmm. And it's still very much the South, but people don't, they think, oh, Miami, palm trees, the Caribbean. I was like, hold on. I mean, this, and you know, the Satan, people call him the Satan. The Satan is showing y'all.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, that is very much a.
I'm saving that. I never realized people were calling him that. And I'm,
the Satan. The Satan. But she, you know, she said that, and I was just, my mouth like literally hit the floor because I was just like, I live with this person and she said this. And so, Brittany being the more, I would say patient, no, not patient, but better at like directly talking to people who make statements like this. Cause my instinct is like, bitch, what the hell? And we can't, you know, I can't do that in class, cause then it becomes like a whole thing. And then like, I'm the disruptive one, right? But Brittany's like, you don't, someone lost their child. You don't think that's a big deal? Like, she sat, like, Brittany sat there and talked her through it. And she still was like, it wasn't clicking. But I remember later telling her about maybe a similar case, and I left out race. She was completely empathetic. And so I'm like, what is that? Like, you know, like there's something like blocking in there. And I can only imagine that also in Missouri, which Missouri is also like one of those states, like, is it the South? Is it the Midwest? It's kind of both. Right. Mm-hmm. And I remember Marcellus, when he came to Texas, he was like, I thought Missouri was a deep South. And me and another friend, we like laughed. It was like, oh, sweetie, you ain't seen nothing yet.
There is something about being on the different, like, end. If you're on the West Coast or East Coast, or mm-hmm. if you live far up north, there's something mm-hmm. about you pass the middle of the U.S., like, mm-hmm. horizontally speaking, and it's like, oh, the South. And I just remember also just being so worried before going to Missouri, not understanding just how, like, now I love percentages, I love math a little bit more than I used to, and when you look at like a city or an area's population, being mm-hmm. like, there's only 15% of the city's population is Black, and you can say that, like, maybe for Columbia, and that's still like hundreds of people potentially. Yeah. Versus like that same percentage in Houston is like thousands, quite possibly. So there's
yeah
but I really did, I thought it was Missouri.
I mean, it is like what Jamie was saying, it is on this, like, it straddles the Midwest Southern sort of relationship, because like southeast and Southwest Missouri is so close to like Arkansas and Tennessee, and but then like the further north you go, I mean, also St. Louis, like St. Louis is like a sister city, I feel like, to Memphis. Like, so many folks went from the actual deep South further north to places like St. Louis and Chicago, and so like those influences are still felt. Yeah. But that's so funny, you thought Missouri was deep South. It is.
We were just like, Marcellus. I was like, you know, you from California. I was like, what are you? I think, speaking of the South, I'm really curious about the storytelling. Going back to the Black Creators Forum, and like how Black people in Memphis are telling their stories, and like what kind of stories are happening. Because we talk about often on the show, like, regionalism, and like how we don't see a lot of storytelling coming out of there. There is absolutely people making work about the South who are from the South, but we don't often see that mainstreamed or like getting the attention it deserves. And so I'm very curious to know more about the types of film and things that you're seeing in Memphis.
Yeah, there are some really, really incredible filmmakers in Memphis. Some of them are making work for a long time. Some of them are like newer and younger filmmakers. But I think a lot of what I think about Memphis filmmakers in particular is because we're a city that's not quite a hub for filmmaking. Like, mm-hmm. like Nashville and Atlanta, in terms of like larger scale productions, they tend to think of those two cities first in the South, like, well, also New Orleans. The filmmakers in Memphis have, like, they're always incredibly creative. The community is, like, there. It's one that is, like, very tight-knit in terms of, like, you know somebody, you probably know that person's uh-huh. EP on their project, or you might know their cousin who could potentially help you with costumes. And a lot of people do also work on, like, commercial work that comes to Memphis, too. Use that time from that commercial work to work on their own, like, independent projects. And I think I'm always just, like, really in awe of how much the filmmakers in Memphis are really thinking about, like, okay, I'm living here, I have these resources, I have this community. It does not necessarily mean I have to leave it. It doesn't mean I have to leave Memphis, but there are folks who kind of straddle that, like working in Memphis, but also working in other places, so that way they can continue doing other work here in Memphis. Especially since I've been helping program, since I've been programming our hometowner section, and like when I moved back, I didn't know all of the filmmakers, but as the years have gone on, like I know a good amount of them. I know like their sensibilities as artists. I know the kind of work that they are doing and would like to do. And that's something that I like don't take lightly. I think it's something that makes me even more excited to do my job. We have like a monthly filmmaker forum called Gene Slice, which is what we usually do, like whatever educational topic makes the most sense. So like last month we did one on like writing and the writer's strike. The filmmaker who's based, the two writers who are based here in Memphis, Craig Brewer, who directed like Elamite Is My Name, and then Anna Sikander, who is a writer who's based here in Memphis now. And like having, every time we have a shooting place, I tend to see the same filmmakers, or I see new people who are just like interested in working in film. And a lot of them, you know, want to figure out ways to either continue doing work here, or at least have the tools that like they can really grow and develop here, especially in a city that is like much cheaper than any of these other places that people recommend. And so I think there's a real like spirit. There's incredible, my favorite things to watch from Memphis filmmakers is music videos. Because music here is so incredible, and a lot of the filmmakers here make music videos, and their work is so strong and so fun to watch, and so interesting to see the ways that like people will develop talents as music video directors, and then they'll also make their own shorts and eventually make features. And I think especially with the Black filmmakers and those like, it really is like a, I've done this project and I'll do this for you if you do this thing for me, but also ensuring that like all of us are getting like compensated in the way that we should be, and also just continuing to like develop our own skills so that way we can continue to make Memphis this place for art and filmmaking in a way that like, I feel like if you don't come here, you don't always know that's happening, or you don't watch work from here. And that's also why we like really try to program work from filmmakers across the South, so people really have a sense of like, this is being done across the region, and there are really incredible filmmakers. Like Zaire Love is a filmmaker based in Memphis and also in Mississippi. Kind of, she teaches at Holmes and then comes to, lives and is from Memphis, and she's a filmmaker that like has such a specific vision and is rooted in making sure that like the South and the Black South in particular is honored. And you see that in all of her work, and she's another like filmmaker where I'm like, I'm just honored to be able to work with you and to know you and to support your growth as an artist in whatever way that we can as an organization, but also just like me as an individual person. And so, yeah, I think it's a really, really, really incredible community that like is doing all that it can to make sure that like Memphis is at the forefront, but also that like their own specific points of views are always in the work that they're doing. Which I know can be really hard when you're trying to balance like making money, but also doing what you want to do as an artist, especially in an industry that's very much trying to make it like even harder to do so. So yeah, I think that's the sort of how I'm thinking about Memphis, and I'm sure that other filmmakers would answer this question in so many other different ways. But I think those are some of the things that I just living here, I'm always so excited to see when I see filmmakers or I meet more filmmakers. There's just, as much as we're known for like music and Elvis and all of these things. It's a really like incredible filmmaking community that I'm really honored to get to work with.
I think back to sort of whenever I was first introduced to film festivals, just broadly speaking. I'm sure it was like I had been on YouTube trying to watch different shorts, and someone was like, I'm trying to submit this to Sundance, and then being like, I don't know what that is, and then having an in-person introduction to True False and being like, oh wow, this is a lot of moving pieces. And I think volunteering, probably because I heard maybe you and some other people were volunteering, I was like, that sounds good. And then I'm pretty sure beyond Campus Movie Fest, which was sort of the first time I tried applying to anything, Indie Memphis is the only sort of festival where I feel like I've seen multiple parts of it from a few different angles. Not clearly not as in the, I think, intimately as you would have at this point, but there's something so loving about the way you treat the creators from Memphis and really represent the city in what you try to do. It always feels like there is a beyond pride, I think, a certain amount of protection you put down for preserving that channel, because it's especially being at a point in the pandemic where we're only just now getting some of these festivals back, and some have just gone. Like, there's it, I think the amount of time and effort spent in not only the forum but just making sure that screening at all could happen and the festival was able to continue. I'm really curious how you feel, especially because 2019 to now, not only access to, I feel like, the festival and then festival circuits broadly has probably changed quite a bit, but you mentioned new filmmakers coming up. How do you feel like the state of sort of representation for filmmakers out of, I guess you could open it up beyond Memphis, but like, how do you feel like that scene's changed since you've been learning it and getting, I guess, a broader feel for what the city is like for you as a programmer?
Yeah. Wait, is your question more about like my feeling about film festivals in general, or my feelings about like Memphis?
I guess it's sneakily two questions. Like, and then it's how do you feel festivals have sort of evolved as you've been working in this specific role? Because I know it just you're this year coming back to in person. How is that changing things for you and the work you're doing? And then do you feel like the representation for Black and Brown filmmakers has kind of shifted since a lot of people, I feel like. I feel like I know a few people who just decided, I'm quitting my job and I'm making things now. And what does that do for the faces that you see popping up while programming?
Yeah. One real side quick tangent. I took the first year that I taught the fig, I took y'all to True False and we saw Kate Plays Christine by Robert Greene. And I had not seen any of Robert's work. I didn't know what we were in for. And by the end of that film, I looked at you all, and you all were just like, what did we just experience? What did Caleb take us to? But I think it was worth it. Were we all a little overwhelmed? Yes, but that's okay. But I think in terms of like film festivals for like Black and Brown filmmakers, I think how I'm thinking in response to that question right now is that it's kind of empowering filmmakers to know which film festivals are like best and most supportive for them. Like there are plenty of film festivals and plenty that, you know, support the work of Black and Brown filmmakers, but not just in a like lip service name kind of way, but in a way in which like the experience with the festival is supportive and well thought out, but also in that like a lot of film organizations that have film festivals also do things year round. And so what does that like year round experience look like for filmmakers? I think that's the other piece. And I think that I think about a lot with like talking to filmmakers, regardless if they're a newer filmmaker or they're more established filmmakers, just empowering them with the knowledge that I have and letting them know that like, this is my knowledge of this particular experience. And this is what I can speak to from my role as like a programmer, but also our role in kind of as offering things for artist development, because I never want filmmakers to feel like they're not knowledgeable about what they're coming into, and not in a way that will like, you know, it's just negative about like things, but in a way that like gives them all of the tools, all of the information so they can make decisions in a way that is the best for them. And also because I want people to be a part of things that are really going to actually like fundamentally support them. And so I think with that, with like the pandemic and stuff, there are festivals that very much continue to do that work. And I think the festival and the pandemic also like very much clarified for people what ways are we thinking about how we're funding those particular avenues for filmmakers, whether that's through grants and other like residencies and things like that. I think there is a sort of another side of this. Like this is me thinking a lot about independent filmmaking and how those spaces work, and then like the studio experience is its own sort of different beast that I feel like I'm still, and probably will forever, be learning about what is the best for filmmakers in that process. And so I feel like it needs a lot of like making sure that when an organization says they support filmmakers of color, what does that mean? What does it mean for them? What does it look like? What does their programming look like? What does the breakdown of other things that they do actually say in me? And then also like talking to other people, like have you been to this film festival? Have you been to this organization? Did you apply for this grant? And what was your experience like with that grant? Was it actually beneficial? Did you get what you thought you were going to get out of it? Especially with things that are kind of like attached to celebrity and things like that. Like it's great on paper, but what did this like materially do for you as an artist? Like I'm always thinking about like, what is it doing for you in your artistic practice, but also what is it doing for you like as a person moving every day through the world? Is this a waste of your time and a waste of your own efforts? Because that's what I don't want. I don't want filmmakers to ever feel like this was a waste of the work that I did, because our film festival doesn't exist without filmmakers. Like, we can't function without their work. And therefore, like, what are we doing to encourage that work to be shared with us, but also to encourage it to continue to be made? And so I feel like this slightly isn't answering your question, but this is what I'm thinking about in response to your question.
No, absolutely.
Because I think I just, and also maybe just because we're in the like residency and fellowship headspace, and I'm thinking more about like what are the things we're doing for filmmakers. But yeah, I feel like, you know, representation of this own thing can be really fraught, because because if people are there, that's cool, that's great. But it's also like, what is their actual experience being there? And is it one that you would recommend someone else to experience and go through? Because if that's not the case, then I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to recommend that residency or recommend that grant. because as much as our work is about watching films and programming films, it's also like keeping relationships with filmmakers and really maintaining that trust of, if they did come to me and ask, oh, I'm going to submit to this festival, this is the festival we're submitting to, I will be honest and be like, you could consider this one, or actually you could consider this other one that I know treats their filmmakers really well. What was the other question you asked me? I feel like I didn't answer that one.
No, you. I feel like you also were able to really, I think, answer both my questions. Because I was just thinking about just the fact that, you know, especially when you're dealing with a lot of filmmakers who, whether or not they stay within the independent sort of film classification for the scaling of their work or how they distribute things, there's a lot of trust in, you know, will this get to the audience that, you know, you want it to get to, that it's, you know, will it get on screens? Will there be any sort of support for it, not just from viewers, but from the people who are showcasing it? And I do feel like that sort of vulnerability, knowing that you entered that space more formally at a time when it's like, okay, now we're doing it digitally, now we're coming back, but also there are more people who are doing this for the first time without the same level of resources that maybe, like, this is the 10th year someone's come to the festival, like, because Indie Memphis 98 is when it formed, and if I'm remembering correctly, it was out of University of Memphis. And having those origins and then thinking about what did students at the University of Memphis feel like when the pandemic was starting and they were starting their programs and trying to do work, like, just the environment shifts so much. So I'm glad you kind of even make that distinction of, it's not just, you know, just seeing other people there, seeing filmmakers represented by just being a number on a sheet doesn't work. It has to be, it's the experience, it has to be impactful, or at the very least supportive in a way that makes a difference. Because you're right, someone, whether they're immediately local or within the state as a whole or broadening out to that community, if they come into your space and they're not really welcome, that's a hard door kind of close in your face when you're trying to enter into making work. Mm-hmm. Lots of feels about.
So I'm curious, I guess switching gears a little bit. I'm curious about, are you excited about any films coming out like in Hollywood this year? Is there anything that you want to see? Or has there been anything that you've seen so far that you really, really enjoyed?
Oh, what a question. I feel like it's, when I get to this point in the year, it's so hard for me to think about, like, what's coming out. I'm like, Barbie. I'm excited for Barbie. I would probably do that, like, Barbie, Oppenheimer, double feature, and have the time of my life. I think I genuinely am excited about Barbie. I don't know what we're gonna get from that.
I know. it looks like a wild ride. I'm excited about it too. Yeah. I know people on Twitter are like, we need to come, we need to be all in pink for the movie.
Yes. Another thing that I just went to the American Black Film Festival and they had a little bit of a sneak preview for The Color Purple. Ooh. That's coming out at Christmas. That I'm really excited for. I like got chills just watching the little like trailer they showed us. Because it has such like heavy weights in it, like Taraji P. Henson, Danielle Brooks, and Fantasia, like all of these really incredible Black women that I'm just excited to see make me cry. And And it's like a blend of, I know they're pulling some from the musical and then some from Alice Walker's original book. And so I'm very curious about how that all will come together. So I think I'm excited about that. And then a movie that I have been singing its praises since January, that it's already streaming, so folks listening want to watch this. It's called Rye Lane. It's this Black British rom-com that came out. I originally saw it at Sundance, and it was probably my favorite screening experience of the whole time that I was there in the fold. And it came out on Hulu in March, and we did like a preview screening of it here in Memphis because Miriam and I loved it so much. We like really wanted to bring it to Memphis, and they only did a theatrical release in the UK and didn't do one here. They just released it on streaming here. I really wanted people to like experience it in a theater because it's really beautifully shot and it's just genuinely funny. And the leads have really incredible chemistry, and there's a lot of the like walking around and bantering in a way that is just really, really well done. And in a very particular part of South London that I think really resonates for those who are like Black and British and from Nigeria. But it is such a treat. It's one of my favorite things I have watched so far this year. Highly recommend it. It's called Rye Lane.
Rye Lane.
And then let me know what you think about it when you watch, because it's such a treat. It's like it has the like rewatchability that I feel like you sometimes really need.
Ooh.
With rom-coms, like where if you're having a really bad day, you could just put it on, and that would be exactly what you would need for your day to feel better.
Streaming on Hulu.
It's on Hulu.
Yes. On Hulu. And the lead, the like. I would also just like look up any of the interviews with the leads and the filmmaker who directed it, and then also the two writers. I can also send you all some of the stuff that I've been thinking. But yeah, highlights of the year for me so far. We'll see what the rest of the year has to bring. Who knows?
Have either one of you, it just came out, the trailer just dropped before we started recording, the trailer for Challengers with Zendaya and two white boys. I don't know who they were, but it's I think one is like Michael Fast or something. I don't know. But
another one who was in West Side Story?
Yeah, I think so. Not Michael Fassbender. He's too old. but they had been talking about this movie for like the past 2 years. The trailer just dropped where it's a tennis movie.
I like these two white boys. The two white boys that are in it, I do enjoy them.
That's supposed to be out in September, and I was looking at the trailer, I was like, okay, wait a minute now. I was like, this looks good. Though there were like the comments are like, this movie isn't, I don't know. This is another thing, not to like drag us back into a whole other conversation, but like people, I think media literacy feels like as much media is out, right? Media literacy feels like it's at an all time low. Like people will watch things and they're just like, colors, pictures, people. That's like it's like they're not the brains are not connecting the thing, because people watched that trailer and were like, this movie isn't about anything, and I was like, I don't even really know what this movie is about, but I could follow the trailer and figure out that it's like these two boys vying for her attention, and that somehow she may be manipulating them. Like I got that from the trailer. Like were we not all watching the same thing? But I don't know. I think that's such a tricky thing, I think, to have to navigate as a filmmaker, as someone who just works in visual imagery in general, like media literacy being what it is. And it can, I don't know, I think you just, have to end up just making the things that you want to make, and people who would get it, get it. Those who don't, don't. Not to quote that girl from TikTok, but just like, clearly you don't get it because you're just not that girl. But it is a really interesting, I think, time we're living in, that, you know, media literacy is what it is, especially when there's so much media around us. I don't know if either one of you have thoughts on that statement.
It's just no, I mean, it's hard because it's not even, I hate the argument sometimes from anyone could make it, but I do feel like older generations tend to scapegoat it as where the decline in media literacy is. I think the attention spans of people are not any shorter. We've always found some form of indulging in the media we want to engage with. I think there's a lot of people who will look at their phone and look at TikTok and be like, oh no, it's ruined me. But like, it used to be Vine, and then before that it used to be Instagram. Like, there's always something that's like a potato chip version of the thing you want. You know, when novels were very popular in a specific way and then magazines were created, it's like, no, there's no going back from this moment. We hit the precipice and we're not gonna be able to enjoy art as, you know, we quote unquote should be. But there is something interesting, I think, in trying to figure out, as we get, I think, further and further into a certain intersection of understanding each other's identities and experiences, there's almost this point where the noise of either you go in or you go out of the circle of understanding creates a certain amount of lack of context. Like, I think if I could program something like a short watch list to watch on LGBTQ history, I would for sure throw in Rocky Horror into that lineup, and half the crowd might be appalled at certain terms within the film, but then like the context of when was the film made and who made it, and even just the fact that some people won't understand, I think, certain just media degrades over time in terms of how connected we can be to it beyond that interrogation you do, like the actual, like you were saying, like, how do you read that trailer? Or how do you just like have it wash over you? But I don't know. I mean, I think, and I won't speak for Caleb, but I feel like we were lucky to have gone into programs that were very focused on giving us media literacy. So I know when I'm 80 and I'm only able to retain TikTok noises in my head, at least I'll still be able to watch the news and be like, I don't know, I think that's just, this reporting is not exactly being framed correctly.
I love your old man voice. I think this also kind of goes back to what I was talking about a little bit earlier with like journalism and blogs and like their to come of age like during that particular time, and to have like all of these different publications that were writing about things in their own way or writing about it in similar ways, but there was enough being covered that like you could have a wide breadth of things that you were reading or learning about. And I feel like that's the thing that I'm like really sad for kids to not have. I'm actually, that there are amazing publications that still exist, like that are doing like really cool work and zines and all these other like alternative spaces especially, but there was a way that you could like really go down the rabbit hole and really read really cool stuff. And like the things that I read as a teenager, like reading like Rookie Mag, that was like Abby Gibbonson's thing that was written by teenagers, or even just like the blogs that I read that really kind of formed some of my own like critical understanding of like looking at media and like media analysis. And I think it's just like such a shame that like that whole ecosystem is functioning the way that it has, in part because of capitalism and like the decline of just, you know, paying people what they should be paid for the work that they're doing. And so I feel like it's such a shame because that just really contributes to like how much we're not, some people aren't exposed to things young enough. I mean, sure, there were some things on the internet I probably should not have been reading at the age that I was reading them, but I do think there was like a much safer ecosystem than to like have the space to read things that like may have blown your mind or just like really be a little stupid on the internet, and like that just doesn't quite exist fully anymore. I think people can still do that a little bit on Tumblr because it kind of like died and then it kind of came back. But really on the site for like the anonymity is still kind of possible. But I'm curious for you all, like as teachers now, like how are you sort of facing that kind of the media literacy? How does that even, how does it come up like in the your own work doing as educators? If I may ask a question.
Oh, absolutely. You can ask those questions. It is always so fascinating because it's like different from each class. I could teach the same class three times, and each one, there's always that one class, they like pick up on stuff really quickly. And then there's the other class that it just, and it's like, oh, y'all are making me work really hard for this little check. You know, because I had told, and I think we might have talked about this on an episode before. I told Marcellus, I had my students watch, because we talked about documentary briefly in my performance and video art class, because it's like, it's kind of unavoidable. A lot of fine artists are dabbling in documentary or like using aspects of documentary in their video works. And so we talk about it, and I had them watch Robert Flaherty's Nanook of the North. And they were all supposed to do a reading along with Nanook of the North. And I asked them to come back with questions. And some of them did not question at all the validity of this documentary, or they didn't think there was a problem that all of it is staged, you know? And I was just kind of like, oh, weird. You know, because I specifically remember one student, this was a student of color, saying like, well, you know, there was no standard then, so like he could do that. And I'm like, but you don't see there's issues with how he's representing Indigenous peoples in this work, right? And there's lies being told about this person. So we have to, you know, some classes were able to unpack that, and it led into conversations as well. Like they eventually went into this whole like thing about, because I think that film is shot in Canada, talking about the schools where the kids were taken to and where they found all of those, like, was it like skeletons in the wall in Canada? One of those schools where they were taking in the children away. So like it leads sometimes to really, like some of them are very much in the know. And then some of them are just like, I don't care. I'm just trying to make it through this class. And so it's always been kind of hard challenging those people who are just like, I don't care. I think my hope is that I always kind of like am planting the seeds for them when they move further and they're in a space where they can, I guess, have the capacity to care, that they're thinking more thoroughly about the things that they're watching, the things they're consuming. But a lot of them, it's just like, it's so enmeshed. Like the internet, social media, all of it's so enmeshed in their lives that they don't really give it a second thought. And it's kind of scary that they don't give it a second thought. And I'm like, you know, you're the product, right? With social media, like that's why it's free. Cause you know, you're the product. On TikTok, people are promoting all of these things, all these like you're doing free marketing for these companies. And they're just kind of looking at me like, what does this have to do with the private diet? And it's just like, you know, well, the subject matter of your performance comes from somewhere, right? It comes from life. And these are the things that are happening in life. And so it's always a mixed bag. I've not completely have lost hope for the generations that are coming up. It's just always, it's a mixed bag, which I would imagine the educators before us were also probably saying it's a mixed bag, because some of them are really informed and are, you know, just exhausted by the news cycle. And then some of them are just like, have just shut the world out. It's just any, they're in media circle. Like anything other than that, they're just, I have no space for it, for whatever those reasons may be. But it's challenging because, you know, they don't question things enough, I would say. Like that has been my kind of like, you know, they kind of hero worship too, right? But that's like very old school to hero worship certain like artists and stuff. And I was like, these are people and they make mistakes and sometimes are bad people. Like, you know, I wouldn't hero worship. You can talk about the art for sure, but I don't think these people are role models. I'm gonna tell you that right now. And I was like, I don't have no problem saying it because none of these people pay my checks. So, you know, I will straight up tell you, yeah, that what's his face is a Nazi. I think he's a Nazi, you know? Uh-huh. They're just like, I don't know, man. I'm like,
you do now.
Yeah, exactly. You can't say you don't know now. I told you, you know, yeah. I told you so. But yeah, so it's a mixed bag. They need to ask more questions of things. They just kind of seem blindly accepting. I don't know about you. And this is in Texas, right? In the context of where I was teaching in Texas, it's in a college town. A lot of the students come from, some of them come from major cities, but I would say the majority of them come from smaller towns around Texas that are maybe in close proximity to this college town. And so who knows what their education system looks like in those small towns. So you know, they probably have not been taught to think at all. Like they've just been told to memorize things and that's really it. So, you know, that is the other grander context of where I was teaching. But I don't know, Marcellus, you in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's supposed to have a better school system. Y'all are a blue state.
I mean, yes. But I do feel like the same issue you're having of kind of that initial like openness and interest in and having exposure broadly is still there. It's interesting because I feel like the time I spent in Houston doing essentially the teaching sort of, I guess with the teaching fellowship, more or less is how that program was kind of set up, right? You teach courses, intro courses, and I was doing introduction to video art when I was in Houston. And that class, just because of the way things were set up and also how new teaching video was for the graduate students in that program, I think a little bit. I was told to, you know, have my syllabus ready when I started teaching, and I just made it. I looked at what we were doing for the other courses, and I looked at, you know, talking to Jamie, talking to our mutual friend Hawa, and thinking about how best to structure this and the courses I was in, and I made my syllabus from the ground up and kind of did as much as I could to challenge students. And they were very receptive, not always. And I made sure that they knew they could vocalize that they hated something, but they had to tell me why.
Yeah.
Which helped a lot. And I feel like at the time, so that's 2020. Through 2022, roughly, is kind of when I was teaching that course. And I would say every other student felt like they kind of were, they were invested, they were in, and they were ready to try and understand something. And the other half were, I just want the A. which is unfortunate, but I think that's also just like education broadly. People are, they look at a class or they look at a potential, like, you know, option, and they go, that fits the time period I have availability
yeah.
for.
Yeah.
But now I'm from Pennsylvania and I'm not teaching in something that's specifically a fine arts program. I'm communications. And even the courses I'm in charge of, they're introductory in a similar way, but they're far more fundamentals based. And, you know, the end goal is like, hey, it's not a film program. It's not a specifically an art program. It's, can you edit? Can you shoot? Whether it's video or audio, do you have a broad understanding of communications? And so I'm teaching like TV production. I'm doing corporate video. Digital audio. And so the first semester when I started teaching here, I didn't touch the syllabus that was from the previous year, just so I could see how these students respond to it and what structure do I need to change. And some students were, you see that same sort of like, I want the A, and they're not necessarily engaged with the focus on like advertising and general media, like sort of understanding, like Jamie was saying, you're the product, and no matter what you're watching, if there's a screen, someone paid for that to be on that screen, so you would take it in and absorb it somehow. But the second semester, I shifted a little bit more into trying to specifically target the things that they're watching and helping them break down, like, hey, there's a process for making those things you enjoy. And it's hard to say that they just needed to have it pivot to what they were digesting. But even still, I think there are some students that I've come across where they're excited about the end product and not the process.
Mm.
And so it prevents them from being able to, it's like the same way. I mean, if you learn how to drive, your anxieties may disappear as you understand the rules and how to operate your own car and knowing that there are like standards. But if you really like driving, you might want to go into F1, or you might become like a driver. Like, there's all these avenues for expanding upon your understanding. And I think a lot of people think media literacy is this flat, like, oh, check the box. But you can lose it. There's no way to, if you don't have this engagement with what you're putting in front of yourself, you just start to kind of accept, I think, a lot of things is true.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember trying to get, I would be really grasping for straws sometimes to get students again, I think, to really buy into the idea. I remember having a conversation for a very long time about the show Community, because we had a guest speaker who was working at NBC and tried to name drop it to get kids excited. And some of them were like, I don't know what that is. And other people were like, oh my gosh. You know, like, it was a very split room. Like, there was no, and we talked about it more later, and that's a show. Like, if you don't have great media literacy skills, certain jokes, certain contexts of how that show kind of exists now in terms of, you know, beyond just its narrative, like to the creation of it and what's going on now. Mm-hmm. There's, I don't know, it's like Swiss cheese for the brain when you don't have those skills.
Yeah. Well, I think we have come to the end. Are there any final thoughts? I don't know. Any final thoughts?
Is there anything that you would like to promote or shout out that is mm-hmm. coming in the like future summer months and whatnot, or later this year?
Yeah. Unfortunately, our deadline for the festival just passed last week, but we will likely open submissions again in December, early January. If there are any folks that y'all know or folks that people listening know who have work and want to share it with us, we always are happy to give waivers to filmmakers who are marginalized in any way. But upcoming, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have the festival in the fall and the Black Creators Forum. Also, we're bringing back the pitch rally that we also done previously, that for like a feature-length film for a filmmaker to pitch at the festival. So we'll have that, and we'll also have Black Creators Forum sessions that are actually in person again this year, which is really exciting to be able to bring that back a little bit more. But we'll still do the virtual weekend the weekend before, the 21st and the 22nd. So if you can't join us in person, or you still are being really COVID conscious, you're welcome to join us virtually. We'll still have a lot of hopefully really cool sessions for that. And then the festival is October 24th through the 29th. And it'll have a virtual component and also an in-person component. So if you also can't come to Memphis in person, you're welcome to watch things at home. Usually our shorts are available like globally. So if there's anyone outside of the US who wants to watch things. And we also have like artist development opportunities year-round. A lot of our programs are for those based in Memphis, but residency that I mentioned is a program that for folks outside of Memphis, they're welcome to apply to. They can spend 2 months working on a feature-length script and really just time to write and do the work that you would like to do, but also be connected to other things if you want to, like location scout, other things like that. So those are the big things that I think we have coming up. I do have a micro cinema next month that is a program that is our monthly short film screening series, and we're doing a partnership with the ODU Film Festival in Brazil and screening some work by some Black Brazilian indigenous filmmakers. That program will be in person, but it'll also be virtual. We haven't announced that yet, but it'll be announced by the time this is up on the internet for people to listen to. And so that's something that I'm really excited to do, something that I think another part of the way that we think about partnerships, like what are other people doing really cool like film work and supporting filmmakers in a way that we can work together. But yeah, I think those are the big things indie Memphis wise coming up. And I'm seeing Beyonce in July. That's Ooh. Not anything to work, but I'm excited.
Do you have your Renaissance outfit picked out?
No, I need to figure it out. Because I need to really figure it out this week before it gets to like too close to order or anything. Mm-hmm. I'll figure it out. I've seen too many photos. Like I can't slack.
It has to be something shiny. Something. It's like there's so many different things happening with this. Like, is it like disco cowgirl? Is it space alien, sci-fi, future? Ah. It's like all these things happening. So it's like, you can't go wrong, as long as it's shiny.
Don't worry. Don't worry. Thank you, I needed to hear that.
All right, well, Kayla, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate you being here. If you all like this episode, make sure that you comment, rate, and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram, on TikTok, as well as on Twitter. We are at Where I See Me on Instagram and Twitter, and at Where I See Me Podcasts on TikTok.
I want to give, as always, a lovely thank you to Playdate for giving us our tunes that we play at the end of every episode. Their song, Why Don't We Talk About It? And as always, they got new tunes out on the interwebs, so go have a play date with Playdate for your music listening times. I have been Marcellus,
and I have been Jamie.
Stay nerdy
and stay Black.
Sensational.